Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Gregory Stockel, and Anna Mateo. Later, Dorothy Gundy and Ashley will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Russia is carrying out a major offensive on the last Ukrainian stronghold in the eastern Luhansk area. The local governor said Russian troops are pouring fire on the city of Lysychansk from the ground and air. Luhansk Governor Serhii Haidai said Russian forces were attacking Lysychansk after recently capturing the neighboring city of Severodonetsk. The Russian offensive aims to capture the larger Donbas area from Ukrainian government control. Western experts say capturing the Donbas has become the new main goal of Russian President Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine. The war has now lasted 5 months. After the takeover of Severodonetsk, the enemy army has concentrated all its forces on capturing our last stronghold in the Luhansk region, Lysychansk, Haidai told the Associated Press. Over the past week, the Russian army has captured several villages and towns southeast of Lysychansk. It is launching airstrikes and artillery fire from those towns. The office of President Volodymyr Zelensky said at least 6 civilians were killed and 31 others injured during Russian attacks on several cities in the past day. Kyiv and some cities in the south and east also came under attack. Russian forces continued to target the southern port of Odessa. A missile attack there destroyed apartment buildings and injured 6 people. In Lysychansk, at least 5 buildings in the city and the last road bridge were damaged over the past day, Haidai said. An important highway connecting the city to government-held territory further south could not be used because of shelling. But the highway has not been captured yet, he said. The fighting is also making the evacuation of civilians more difficult, Haidai said. The city had a pre-war population of around 100,000, about half of whom remain. Lysychansk is on the Seversky-Donets River and is a large area covered with hills. This gives an advantage to Ukrainian troops, military experts say. The Seversky-Donets River borders Lysychansk on the north and east. The Ukrainian army continues to hold territory west of the city, which it uses to supply arms and humanitarian aid. Russian forces have now moved to block Lysychansk from the south. To the west, in the government-controlled city of Slovyansk, local officials accused Russian forces of using a cluster bomb Monday. They said it hit a civilian neighborhood. A cluster bomb is a kind of explosive that contains many smaller bombs and is considered very deadly. Officials say the number of dead and injured has not yet been confirmed. The shockwave from a big explosion Monday in Slovyansk destroyed most of the windows in the surrounding apartment buildings and nearby cars. Monday, a Russian missile struck a crowded shopping center in Ukraine's central city of Kremenchuk, officials said. Dozens of civilians were feared killed or wounded. Officials said there were more than 1,000 civilians inside the shopping center at the time of the attack. Meanwhile, leaders of the Group of Seven countries meeting in Germany appeared willing to provide Ukraine with air defense systems. Russia hit Kyiv with long-distance missiles on Sunday. The U.S. appeared ready to announce the purchase of a surface-to-air missile system for Ukraine. I'm Dan Novak.
Companies across the world are re-examining their sources for many kinds of goods because of supply issues linked to the COVID-19 pandemic. Many businesses, from multinational clothing makers to electronics manufacturers, are considering other countries for imports as they move away from China. China was hit hard by the pandemic, and the government established a zero-COVID policy. This led to widespread problems in the worldwide supply chain. Experts say that means countries in Southeast Asia and Latin America are becoming new go-to places for much-needed goods. Jian Menon is a visiting representative with the ICIS Youssef Ishak Institute's Regional Economic Studies Program in Singapore. He told VOA that since the pandemic, China's traditional role as the world's factory will be reduced. American and European multinational companies will now be looking for parts, labor, and factory processes elsewhere. Menon said countries like China that mismanage COVID will suffer greatly. He said that is because their zero COVID efforts have caused major problems for supply chains. When Southeast Asian countries, including Vietnam, Thailand, and Indonesia, were lifting pandemic restrictions, China set lockdowns in two major cities. The lockdowns affected factory orders and caused worker shortages, which raised product prices. Nations such as Vietnam and Thailand were already taking business from China before 2020. This was largely linked to rising Chinese labor costs and higher taxes that resulted from a trade dispute between China and the United States. Menon said, "I think Southeast Asia will clearly be a beneficiary of all this reconfiguration taking place." He said countries like Vietnam, and to a lesser degree Thailand and Malaysia, have already seen gains from restructuring of supply chains. Menon added that Vietnam has a lead because of its skilled workforce, pro-business reforms, and a network of free trade agreements. Electronics companies Samsung and Intel both operate in Vietnam, as do foreign invested car factories. Rajiv Biswas is an economist with S&P Global Market Intelligence in Singapore. He told VOA that multinationals are likely to expand industrial abilities or capacity in multiple places. but they are expected to stay in China for its market of a billion plus people. Biswa said they will continue producing in China, but they will create additional production capacity in other hubs. In Latin America, especially its industrial hub of Mexico, products have been selling to the all-important U.S. market. Mexico is expected to keep benefiting from a process called nearshoring. This is based on the idea that since Mexico and the U.S. have a common time zone and similar culture and languages, it is easier for American businesses to do business there than in other places. Evan Ellis is a professor of Latin American Studies at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. He said Brazil makes sense as a place to do business for companies in need of the country's natural resources. Ellis said Brazil can also be a good market for companies selling cars. This is because the country has a market of 212 million people, many of whom live in middle-class cities. Ellis noted, however, that costs and local laws can cause difficulties for investors in Brazil. I'm Gregory Stockel.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Home gardeners are becoming more educated about the importance of native plants in the ecosystem. With a deeper knowledge of native plants, many gardeners are turning to something called rewilding. This is an approach to gardening and landscaping that uses native plants to feed, house, and protect insects, bees, birds, and butterflies. Gardening expert Jessica Damiano writes for the Associated Press. She explains the ways gardeners are rewilding their property. Those ways include getting rid of their lawns, areas with just grass, replacing non-native plants with native ones, not clearing up plants in the fall to keep food and shelter for overwintering birds and insects, and making their property a habitat for wildlife. However, other gardeners may worry about having a messy garden. They also may be worried about the work and cost of completely redoing their garden. Other people may be limited by their property agreements or neighborhood restrictions. Well, here is some good news. Rewilding does not have to be all or nothing. It is possible to slowly introduce native plants to a traditional, already established garden. Just one native potted plant that feeds one pollinator will make a difference. Including a few natives alongside traditional garden plants, whether in containers or in the ground, will create a more sustainable garden that appeals to helpful insects. Here is more good news. Native plants are generally drought tolerant. That means they can survive long periods of time without water. If replacing your entire lawn with native ground cover sounds like too big of a job, consider making the lawn smaller. You can also put in new plant beds and borders or enlarge existing ones. Then you can fill them with plants native to your area. This will lead to more bees and butterflies. Your flowering plants, fruits, and vegetables will bloom better with the help of more pollinators. You will also have less garden work, like cutting, weeding, watering, and fertilizing. And in the end, you will most likely save money. Damiano says that planting native wildflowers is the best idea. However, for some people, wildflower gardens can look a bit too wild and messy. If that is not what you or your neighbors want, you can create a border of grass to contain the wildflowers. This will keep the garden looking neat. Damiano lives near New York City. Over the last several years, she has slowly rewilded her garden. She has less lawn, and the lawn that is left is seeded with clover. Clover flower attracts pollinators. Clover also fixes nitrogen into the soil. It is a fertilizer you do not have to pay for. Damiano writes that she kept her hydrangeas, roses, and lilacs. But now the only new plants she brings home are natives. After just a few years, native plants already outnumber non-native plants in her garden. That will continue as her old garden favorites die and are replaced with plants that belong in the area. Through this process, Damiano says she has discovered many beautiful flowering native plants, like Jacob's ladder, turtlehead, and buttonbush. These all provide food for pollinators. With her roses, she planted gay feather, bee balm, and milkweed. Milkweed serves as the only food source for monarch butterfly caterpillars, she writes. In the autumn, she still collects her leaves, but she no longer bags them up for the trash collector. Now the dead leaves are used as winter mulch for the garden, and they serve as a winter home for helpful insects. Damiano says a complete rewilding of her garden will take several more years to complete, and that is fine with her. It is another step in the right direction. In gardening, as in life, she says her goal is to work toward progress, not perfection. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Today, on our national parks journey, we travel to the largest state in terms of land area, Alaska. Alaska is home to more national parks than any other state. It is also home to North America's tallest mountain, the 6,190-meter high Denali Peak. The peak gives the surrounding protected area its name. Welcome to Denali National Park in central Alaska. Denali's grounds cover more than 2.4 million hectares. Within the park are glaciers, clear rivers, peaceful forests, and wildlife such as wolves, moose, bears, and sheep. Denali National Park seems huge, yet only one road goes through the park. Hundreds of thousands of visitors travel down that road each year to experience the Alaskan wild.
Denali National Park was first established 100 years ago. At the time, the park and North America's tallest mountain were known by another name. Many Americans knew the famous peak as Mount McKinley. In the late 1800s, gold miners unofficially named the peak after William McKinley, the 25th U.S. president. At the time, McKinley was still a presidential candidate. McKinley himself never traveled anywhere near the mountain, but the name stuck. In Alaska, however, locals continued to call the mountain Denali. The word Denali means the high one for the Athabascan people, many of whom lived north of the mountain. The area became a national park on February 26, 1917. Its name was Mount McKinley National Park. Some naturalists disagreed with the naming decision. A debate continued for more than half a century, a sign of the area's long and complex history.
In 1975, Alaskan state officials asked the federal government to change the name to Denali to honor the Native Alaskans. But congressional members from the state of Ohio, where McKinley was from, opposed and blocked the renaming efforts. In late 1980, weeks before his presidency ended, Jimmy Carter increased the size of the park from 800,000 hectares to 2.4 million hectares. The expanded park also took on a new name. It became the Denali National Park and Preserve. The naming debate, however, was not over. Although the park took the name of Denali, the mountain itself still remained Mount McKinley for another 35 years. In August 2015, former President Barack Obama officially changed the name from Mount McKinley to Denali. The announcement was made shortly before Obama traveled to Alaska. His visit was aimed at publicizing the effects of climate change in the state.
The animals living within Denali National Park are just as famous as its tallest peak. In fact, Denali was the first national park created in order to protect wildlife. The park is home to 39 kinds of mammals and over 160 kinds of birds. Many people come to Denali to see the park's largest mammals. Some moose here weigh well over 500 kilograms. More than 1,700 caribou live within the grounds. Doll sheep flock together on hillsides. Wolves are everywhere in the park. Denali is known as one of the best places to observe wolves in the wild. Giant grizzly bears can also be seen. They enjoy catching salmon and eating wild berries in the summer. Denali also protects the remains of a prehistoric ecosystem. In 2005, geologists discovered fossilized evidence of dinosaur tracks within Denali. Tests showed the fossil to be about 70 million years old. It was the first sign of dinosaurs in central Alaska. Since then, scientists have discovered more than 300 fossil sites. The fossils preserve evidence of other ancient creatures and many kinds of plants. With each discovery, a more complete picture of Denali's past comes to life.
Adventure-seeking travelers visit Denali to climb North America's tallest peak. The first successful climb to the very top happened on June 7th, 1913, when four men reached the summit. Every year, more than 1,000 people try to reach Denali's summit. Only about half of them succeed. Climbing Denali is extremely difficult. Climbers face harsh conditions and extreme weather. Winds can blow at speeds of more than 160 kilometers an hour. They must use special equipment to travel along glacier ice and difficult terrain. The Kahiltna Glacier is the longest glacier here. Climbers know it as the starting point for summiting Denali. It sees some of the most extreme temperatures of any place on Earth. Most successful climbs take about 3 weeks. Several local businesses offer group climbs.
Visitors can enjoy Denali in more restful ways, too. Many people travel by bus along the park's single road. Travel companies offer half-day bus tours. Others choose to ride bicycles along the long road. This gives them a chance to get up close to Denali's wildlife and peaceful environment. The park operates 6 campsites and offers several kilometers of trails. Denali is also home to a group of sled dogs. These Alaskan huskies are an important part of the park experience. Visitors can watch sled dog demonstrations in the summer to learn about this traditional Alaskan way of travel.
The park's past, present, and future connect many different cultures and people across time. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.